News, I'm Michael Brown. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is threatening to identify, arrest, and try protesters who are taking part in street demonstrations. The unrest in Venezuela is also turning into a battleground of rhetoric between the United States and Russia. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.S. was prepared to use military action in Venezuela.
Military action is possible. If that's what's required, that's what the United States will do. We're trying to do everything we can to avoid violence. We've asked all the parties involved not to engage in that kind of activity. We'd prefer a peaceful transition of government there, where Maduro leaves and a new election is held. But the president has made clear, in the event that there comes a moment, and we'll all have to make decisions about when that moment is, and the president will ultimately have to make that decision, he's prepared to do that if that's what's required.
Russia's foreign minister warned of the most drastic of consequences if the U.S. continues what it calls aggressive steps. The United States and the Taliban are beginning a new round of negotiations in an effort to move the peace process forward. However, a senior U.S. military commander says no decision has been made about the presence of U.S.-led NATO forces in Afghanistan. The insurgent group has insisted on finalizing an agreement on the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces from Afghanistan before discussing other issues. The Taliban said it is vital that the two key agenda points of the previous meeting, full withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan and preventing Afghanistan from harming others, be finalized. The Taliban has so far refused to hold direct official talks with the Afghan government and has insisted on continuing to directly talk with the United States. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. U.S. Attorney General William Barr appeared before Congress Wednesday defending his decision on the handling of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's March report on Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election. Mueller wrote that he had found no evidence of collusion between President Trump's campaign and Russia during the election, but that he could not reach a conclusion about whether Trump had obstructed justice. Barr testified why he did not pursue obstruction charges against the president.
The placeholder, in my judgment, was the simple statement of what the bottom line conclusions were.
Democrats accused Barr of grossly understating evidence of Trump's misconduct in the summary in an effort to justify his controversial decision to exonerate the president of obstructing justice during the investigation. Many South Africans say they're fed up with the longtime ruling African National Congress ahead of a general election. Now, as South Africa marks 25 years of ANC rule, that sentiment appears to have also spread to an area the ANC has long considered safe, the countryside. VOA's Anita Powell reports from rural Cape.
Many are turning to opposition parties like the Democratic Alliance or the Economic Freedom Fighters, but many others are simply staying away. In a small maize farming town of Wolmaranstad, unemployed voter Tsepo Mosweu says he has lost hope that the ANC will bring improvements since the death of ANC icon Nelson Mandela.
And I do have hope that sooner or later the oppositions will also take power here in Bloemhof.
Will that happen? Or will the rural areas stand by the ruling party? South Africa finds out on May 8th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Northern Cape, South Africa.
WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange has a court hearing Thursday in London over his U.S. extradition requests on charges of conspiring to break into a Pentagon computer system. Britain will decide whether to extradite Assange to the U.S. in response to allegations that he conspired with a former U.S. intelligence analyst to download classified databases. On Wednesday, Assange was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for breaching bail conditions. Assange was sentenced for breaching his bail by entering the Ecuadorian embassy 7 years ago. And Israel is observing one of its most solemn days of the year, Holocaust Remembrance Day, with the president warning the government not to get too cozy with some Europeans. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has hosted Hungary, Lithuania, Poland, all of whom visited Israel's Holocaust Museum, but whose right-wing governments have been accused of downplaying their country's roles in the mass murder of Jews during World War II. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's media regulator orders the suspension of 39 journalists.
We are not intimidated at all. We will continue to do our work in a balanced way. And on World Press Freedom Day, I'd like to call upon the government of Uganda to respect the freedom of speech and media freedom in Uganda.
Joyce Bagala is head of news and current affairs at the Next Media Services, the committee to protect journalists, says it is concerned about a $500,000 lawsuit brought against a Liberian radio station. Kenyan workers demand wage increment on International Labor Day. And as South Africa prepares to vote on May 8, some rural voters say they will vote for change.
We are going to vote for EFF. It's either we go for DA or EFF, but we must change. There's a rate of unemployment, there's a rate of poverty, there's a rate of... Look at this road here.
The South African rural voter Shepel Mutsoe and a visit with the Abatwa people of Rwanda on International Labor Day. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan journalists say they will continue to report the news in a balanced way without fear of intimidation. This comes after the Uganda Communications Commission on Wednesday ordered the suspension of 39 journalists at 13 different media houses. In separate letters, the commission reportedly accused the media houses of airing programs that have extremist messages, including incitement of violence for political and other purposes. Observers say the suspensions are a result of the government's displeasure with the media coverage of the arrest and detention earlier this week of parliamentarian and popular musician Bobby Wine. Joyce Bagla is head of news and current affairs at the Next Media Services, which owns NBS Television. She says Next Media is working with its lawyers to assess the commission's demands.
The letter last evening, and our lawyers are still going through it. In the meantime, we are waiting for a meeting with the Uganda Communications Commission because they made a directive that we should go there and have an interface and do some kind of explanation and give them some material that we could have used to air stories about Honorable Robert Chagulani, who is the Member of Parliament. They were saying that there was repeated breach of the minimum broadcasting standards that included, according to the claim in the letter, extremist messages inciting the public and misrepresentation of information, which are actually not true, according to myself as head of news. As someone who oversees the production of the news, it is not true that we put out extremist messages. It is not true that we incite the public, and it is not true that we misrepresent information.
And I was looking at some parts of the letter as quoted in this article. The commission is accusing you of broadcasting unbalanced and sensational messages or news. This has to do with, is that correct, as you mentioned, the treatment of Bobby Wine. How would you assess the coverage that you gave of the Bobby Wine's arrest?
We are balanced. The difference is that we are really bold, but we are balanced. Every time we have stories of that nature, we contact with the government spokesperson. We also contact the police. And in this case, in all the days that police are running battles with Honorable Chagulani, we have the police speak. So there's no way we are imbalanced. So the stories are really, really balanced.
This news is coming a day before International World Press Day. Talk to me in the context of the media in Uganda. What do you think is the state of the media?
Certainly, if you have been following social media in Uganda since yesterday, there's been a lot of concern, and the media, most of the media personalities, from the way they were expressing themselves, there seems to be some kind of fear, as if they're being intimidated. Probably that's what the government would like to do. But what I would say is that we are not intimidated at all. We will continue to do our work accurately in a balanced way. And on World Press Freedom Day, I'd like to call upon the government of Uganda to respect the freedom of speech and the media laws of the country and media freedom in Uganda.
I don't know, maybe you can clarify for our listeners, because those of us in the international media, sometimes we've had difficulty trying to reach the Ugandan government officials. Whenever there's a news story about Uganda, it's hard to get the officials to come quickly and respond to an event that has been reported. What is the experience of local Ugandan journalists?
Certainly, many government officials are very reluctant to respond where they need to defend government or make clarifications. But I'd like to say that the government spokesperson, who is Ofwono Opondo, is always ready and willing. And I'd like to give him credit, because most of the time that was needed him for a comment, for responses, for reactions, he's been readily available.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Joyce Bagala is head of news and current affairs at the Next Media Services, which owns NBS Television. She is speaking with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The Committee to Protect Journalists says it is concerned about a $500,000 civil defamation lawsuit brought against the Roots FM radio station and two of its hosts by Liberia's Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Nathaniel McGill. Roots FM carries the Henry Costa talk show, which has been critical of the government of President George Weah. The lawsuit describes the Costa show as a very divisive program that rivals the pre-1994 Radio Rwanda style of broadcasting. Jonathan Rosen is the Africa program researcher for the Committee to Protect Journalists. He says lawsuits involving massive claims for damages remain a major challenge to press freedom in Liberia.
The $500,000 defamation civil lawsuit against Roots FM in Liberia should be concern to all those who value press freedom, because of the history of the way civil defamation suits have been used against journalists in Liberia. This suit, in the Liberian context, would cripple the news station. The prospect for journalists to go to prison if they are unable to pay lawsuits has been proven in Liberia. And certainly it would bankrupt the news agency.
Mr. Nathaniel McGill, the Liberia Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, who filed this suit, said that he is suing to clear his name. What's wrong with that?
The problem with the lawsuit is the very large sum in damages that is being claimed. To ask for this amount of money from a radio station in response for their reporting doesn't take into consideration adequately the Liberian context and shows a disregard for the implications that would have for the news station's continued operation.
This is not to suggest that if, say, a radio station or a newspaper goes wrong in terms of coverage, that it should not take responsibility. What's the suggestion from the CPJ in terms of what should be done in terms of accountability?
Our hope is that the civil defamation law in Liberia is reformed to include greater consideration for the way that large penalties or large damages would impact news stations.
As we get ready to celebrate or commemorate World Press Freedom Day, which is going to be on Friday, May 3rd, put this Liberia story in the context of World Press Freedom Day.
Well, World Press Freedom Day is incredibly important because it's an opportunity to put a spotlight on the role of journalism in society around the world and in Africa. And this Liberian case showcases one challenge that journalists continue to face around the world. And we hope that the reform efforts that have been made by the Liberian government will continue, and that the laws that continue to be used against journalists in Liberia will be reformed in the same fashion as the criminal defamation law was in February.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Jonathan Rosen is the Africa Program Researcher for the Committee to Protect Journalists. You're speaking with me from New York. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 2nd. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. It was a bad day for Kenyan workers who waited for long for their salary increment to be announced during yesterday's International Labor Day celebrations in Nairobi. Speaking during the event, Labor Cabinet Secretary Okur Yatani said that the salary increment was still at the negotiation stage and will be announced soon. But as Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the Federation of Kenya Employers did not attend the celebration.
Kenyans' expectations of salary increment was cut short after the Labour Cabinet Secretary, who represented President Uhuru Kenyatta, failed to announce the minimum and general wage increase they were expecting. During his address in Nairobi, the Labour Cabinet Secretary Okur Yatani told Kenyans that the 15% increment will be looked into in the future since the discussions are ongoing.
I also wish to say that here we are still in the process of negotiating at the wages and wages councils between the employers and the employees, so that a negotiation on the whether there's going to be a wage increase, I think we are going to discuss later in the course of the week. I wish to reiterate the government's commitment to the spirit of job creation, social dialogue, sound labor relations, and social protection for the vulnerable.
Kenyans who attended the event felt left out, as most of the workers, unionists, and the political class in attendance addressed their political needs. Eugene Ogola says his expectations were not considered.
I expected this government to inform the general public that this is a particular period that they are going to take all engineers who are graduate engineers to employ them on an internship.
Another Kenyan, Andrew Juma, complains of a high cost of living in the country that he says it's unmanageable for most Kenyans.
Expecting something on my meager earnings. But now, look, endless entertainment, just PR, endless shows, no salary increment. We already burdened. Housing levy, extra taxation, high cost of living, everything is very high.
The Central Organizations of Trade Union Secretary General Francis Atwoli, who many Kenyans looked up to defend them, seemed to be addressing government issues and not the workers. Atwoli, however, urged the government to ensure the 15% wage increment is implemented.
International Labour Day team reads, eradicate corruption to create jobs. This is the single important reason why call to support the handshake and your valid position, Mr. Minister and the government, in fighting corruption in this country.
Mr. Yatani also assured Kenyans that his ministry has put in place mechanism to end the rampant cases of industrial action in the country, which he says have continued to deny Kenyans essential services.
The industrial relations landscape in the country has been quite turbulent in the recent past, particularly in the public sector, with the health and education sectors as the most affected. The strikes and work stoppages have continued to deny Kenyans essential services and inflicting immeasurable suffering and inconvenience, not mentioning the negative image it portrays of the country as a shaky investment destination.
The political leaders complained about the government's inability to improve working conditions and salaries amid tough economic times, widespread corruption, and taxation through the 1.5% levy for President Kenyatta's affordable housing plan. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Many South Africans say they are fed up with the long-time ruling African National Congress, ANC, ahead of the country's general election on May 8th. As South Africa marks 25 years of ANC rule, the sentiment appears to have also spread to an area the ANC has long considered safe, the countryside. VOA's Anita Powell reports from rural Northern Cape.
Every 5 years, residents of this dry, remote corner of northwestern South Africa say the ruling party comes out here and asks for their vote. And in every one of the last four general elections, the majority of voters has given it and allowed the African National Congress to maintain a comfortable majority in rural South Africa. In the sparsely populated, largely rural provinces of the Free State and the Northern Cape, the ANC won between 64 and 69% of the vote in the last election in 2014. Political polls show that the ANC is poised to lose support from 62% nationwide in 2014 to as little as 57% this year. The party has dominated every national poll since the beginning of democracy in South Africa in 1994.
But this year, rural voters say things will change. Olga Fakazi, a 38-year-old nurse, said she voted for the ANC in 2014. This year, disgusted by corruption and poor service delivery in her small town, she says she plans to boycott the polls entirely.
They're just like concentrating on all these big towns, but here in the rural places, they're not even coming. They're not coming to us. They're not coming to us. So I don't see why I should vote for the ANC. Really, I'm not going to vote for the ANC.
26-year-old Matabo Mokopane, a resident of another small town in this dry corner of South Africa, says she plans to do the same. Her town is ANC-run, and she also voted for it previously. Mokopane says this time around, she will not.
The people we are voting for, actually, when we finish voting for them, they don't look after the community anymore.
They're among a growing demographic of disillusioned ANC supporters, says political analyst Ivor Sarakinsky. Many are turning to opposition parties like the Democratic Alliance or the Economic Freedom Fighters, but many others are simply staying away.
Just because the ANC numbers might go down doesn't mean that the urban areas have swung to opposition parties. The ANC's got an internal opposition in terms of the voters not voting because they're dissatisfied with the ANC, their party of choice.
In a small maize farming town of Wolmaranstad, unemployed voter Tsepo Mosweu says he has lost hope that the ANC will bring improvements since the death of ANC icon Nelson Mandela, known by many South Africans simply as Tata.
ANC failed us. This morning, we are going to vote for EFF. It's either we go for DA or EFF, but we must change because of Tata leave a legacy for us. But what about us? There's a rate of unemployment, there's a rate of poverty, there's a rate of... Look at this road here.
But hope is alive in the nearby town of Bloemhof, says Martha Paketti, an energetic 30-year-old who recently took to the streets of this dusty town to campaign for the opposition Democratic Alliance.
Yes, the rural areas are changing. They are starting to see the light because they've been lied to for so many years. But to tell the truth, we as the opposition, we only need to work very hard to show these people that they've been used from 1994 until now, only for the benefits of certain families. So they are starting to see light, and I do have hope that sooner or later the oppositions will also take power here in Bloemhof.
Will that happen, or will the rural areas stand by the ruling party? South Africa finds out on May 8th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Northern Cape, South Africa.
Africa has seen a wave of protests that led to regime changes in three countries, Sudan, Algeria, and Zimbabwe. As viewers Mariama Diallo reports, activists are now watching to see if the changes they were hoping for actually take place.
Months of demonstrations helped Sudanese people end the 30-year rule of President Omar al-Bashir. Sudanese activists want to see major change in governance, says analyst Raymond Gilpin.
They want institutions that serve all the people. So over the short term, they have replaced an individual. They've gotten rid of al-Bashir. But the wheels of institutional change are grinding a little bit more slowly.
Large protests in Algeria also helped push former Algerian leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika.
Algeria, as you know, started with the price hikes, and then we had the issue of the fifth term for Bouteflika, and people had had enough.
Bouteflika has been replaced by the head of the upper house of parliament until a presidential election in July. Algeria's army chief, who was instrumental in Bouteflika's downfall, says the military will watch over the transition.
In Algeria, like in most countries, use security and the military interchangeably. And the security that matters to most of the citizens is not what the military can provide. It's what the police provide. Law and order. And absence of civil unrest.
In Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe was replaced after 37 years, but governance changed very little. Soaring inflation, fuel costs, and shortages of basic foods sparked months of protests that escalated into riots.
The fact that we've had such explosive and costly in terms of lives and property riots and unrest in Zimbabwe speaks to the fact that that state-society relationship is still fractured.
In Uganda, people protested against a constitutional amendment that allows President Yoweri Museveni to run for another term. Opponents accuse Museveni of using security crackdowns to hold on to power. At a recent talk in Washington, activist Scovia Arinetwe recalls being thrown in jail shortly after major surgery.
And I was in police custody for 5 days. No medical attention. No being produced in court.
While protesters keep pushing for change, the full impact of their fight remains unclear in Uganda and elsewhere in Africa. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
In Rwanda, there is a historically marginalized people known as the Abatwa. Reporter Eugene Uwimana visited them yesterday as they celebrated International Labor Day. They said they are no longer beggars because they are now earning their living by making modern pottery.
Officially, they are called historically marginalized Rwandans, a term for the community of Abatwa people. They earn a living by making pottery because the loss of forest means traditional hunting isn't possible. Zula Mukantunga is 55. She has 12 children. She says, before joining this cooperative, I and my family were beggars. We couldn't get clothes or food by our own hands. She says our lives were so miserable. Zula is decorating a pot which values $5. She says there is a huge market in Kigali. They can make 100 pots a day. She says we are very developed from this profession. Look, I have even a TV set home. I have good furniture, I afford good clothes, and my children can go to school. In 2007, the Rwanda's Senate created a special commission to address the Abatwa community's problems. The commission's data show the community in general is impoverished and declining. However, Fonioite Jean de Dieu, who is one of 58 members of this cooperative, says they hope their children will change the history. He says, we didn't study. All what we have is the pottery, the profession we inherited from our ancestors. This is our degrees, but through these pots, we managed to send our children to school. So maybe there will be someone. Pots of these historically marginalized Rwandans are popular in the city. At their selling points, you find many clients, mostly foreigners. Courier John is Indian businessman.
I have already given the order for 10 pots like this. I think they are doing a wonderful job. Maybe I'll get in touch with them with more orders.
Though these Kigalians are enjoying the city market, their relatives still suffer in different corners of the country. They make pots, yes, but they say they don't have a market. 25 years after the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi, the government, in its effort to promote unity, says there are no ethnic groups or citizens are Rwandans. But the Senate Commission says Abatwa people face separately poor living conditions and high child and maternal mortality. It urges the government to support this community, which is declining from 50,000 before 94 to 36,000 now. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Ugandan journalists say they will continue to report the news in a balanced way without fear of intimidation. This comes after the Uganda Communications Commission on Wednesday ordered the suspension of 39 journalists at 13 different media houses. In a separate letter, the commission reportedly accused the media houses of airing programs that have extremist messages, including incitement of violence for political and other purposes. Observers say the suspensions are a result of the government's displeasure with the media coverage of the arrest and detention earlier this week of parliamentarian and popular musician Bobby Wine. And the Committee to Protect Journalists says it is concerned about a $500,000 civil defamation lawsuit brought against the Roots FM radio station and two of its hosts by Liberia's Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Nathaniel McGee. That's it for this Thursday, May 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on The Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Yes, sir.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1500 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.